Hi, I'm Rudyard Griffiths, the Executive Director of The Hub. Welcome to In Conversation with David Frum. On this program, you'll hear big thinker and writer David Frum's exclusive analysis of contemporary events, issues, and ideas for The Hub. In Conversation with David Frum is hosted by The Hub's Editor-at-Large, Sean Spear. If you're enjoying this program, please visit our website at www.thehub.ca for more great insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, Editor-at-Large at The Hub. I'm honored to be back in conversation with David Frum for another installment of our bi-weekly video and podcast series on the key issues concerning Canadian policy and politics. In today's conversation, we'll discuss the recent escalation of pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses across North America, and what, if anything, these developments tell us about higher education, the failings of institutional leadership, and the cultural and intellectual conditions that enable anti-Semitism to flourish. David, thanks as always for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Last night, New York police arrested students involved in the barricade of a Columbia University building over the past 24 hours or so. It ended what on one hand seemed like an almost satirical protest designed to make fun of the performative progressivism on elite campuses. But on the other hand, it may signal something deeper about the rise of ideological extremism among those who will ultimately fill key roles in our major public and private institutions. What's your immediate takeaway from the one-day barricade at Columbia and the broader escalation of protests that we've seen on North American campuses over the past couple of weeks?
Let's begin by noticing something that has not been happening. There have not been large-scale anti-Israel protests in the streets of North America off campus. Unlike London, unlike what's happening in Europe, off campus, there have been attempts to block bridges, to seize strategic points where small numbers of people can cause a lot of harm. And there have been incidents of actually very sinister activity, like lofting balloons into the flight paths of airplanes at some airports with in an attempt to do harm or to disrupt air traffic. But there have been no big assemblies in the streets. And where there have been, there was one in Washington in January that drew some tens of thousands of people. They've been conspicuously law-abiding. There were only two arrests at the January 13th anti-Israel march in Washington, which brought 250,000 very law-abiding people to walk the Capitol in 1963. This is a movement of highly ideological cadres, many of them with long police records, who are surrounded by a larger group of quite casually motivated university students, undergraduates and graduates, who are not prepared to take a lot of hazards, as we said, the famous thing about why can't we order Grubhub in the building we've seen? Please, nobody eat a banana within 100 yards of me. But off campus, it doesn't exist. So we need to keep in mind, we're dealing with a small movement that has been parasitic on weak rule enforcement at the universities. Where universities have had clear and consistent rules, there have not been disruptions. Where universities have signaled the rules are up for grabs, well, people have tried to grab them. And we've created this dynamic where that is so often the case, and this is one of the standard observations about one of the weak points of modern society. Where rules are hazy and unclear, people push them, and then the society must have a much more forceful response at the end than it would have needed if the rules had been clear from the beginning. I don't think this has a lot of larger political significance. Let me say one more thing about that. There is clearly an attempt by some in the anti-Israel world to hustle the Biden administration by creating a false appearance of political danger on the left.
Yes.
For center-left governments, the great political danger is always weakness in the face of disorder. People have stereotypes. They think that the right is tough but uncompassionate, and they think the left is compassionate but weak. And so if you're on the right, you always need to look for opportunities to show, even though I'm tough, I am also compassionate. And if you're on the left or the center left, you need to show, even though I'm compassionate, I'm also strong. You need to fight against the worst thing that Joe Biden and the people around him can do is to signal we are uncertain about enforcing the rules that apply to all.
A ton of insight there, David. I want to take up your comments about what one might describe as the casual protesters involved in some of these protests and activities across North American campuses. It's striking that a lot of them don't seem to actually know all that much about Gaza, Israel, or the region's history. It prompts the question, why are they protesting? What is it about the Palestinian cause that is faddish and cool?
well, I wish this were my joke, but I can't remember where I heard it, but somebody said the main effect of social media on modern mass movements has been to create a kind of post whose message is, in this time of national tragedy, let's be sure that no one forgets about me. And that social media makes it possible for all of us to be little mini celebrities, to see our face on video. And it's very attractive to people that a lot of what is happening here is done for Instagram. I think there's one of my favorite photographs. Do you remember the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests
yes.
in France? I think it's 2012, they had some kind of riot about the price of gasoline. And the Russians got involved in backing it. There was a photograph that was taken of the Arc de Triomphe, that icon of Paris, seemingly engulfed in flames. And somebody photographed the way that the photograph was taken, which is about a quarter of a mile away from the Arc de Triomphe. Somebody built a little bonfire that was a foot and a half high. And if you as a photographer lay on the ground and shot upward at an angle through the little bonfire, a quarter of a mile away to the Arc de Triomphe, you got the Arc de Triomphe in flames. Meanwhile, at the Arc de Triomphe itself, graffiti and vandalism, which is, you know, graffiti is absolutely unacceptable at a monument to the country's honored dead, obviously, but it's a different order of problem that somebody at 2 a.m. took a spray can to the Arc de Triomphe to be condemned. And then the idea that Paris was on fire and the Arc de Triomphe was in danger of collapsing under the heat. So I think a lot of this is what is going on. And I think there are a lot of angles. And UCLA and Columbia seem a little different, but most of the campuses, that these are small encampments of 40, 50 people, a few hardened cadres, a lot of exhibitionists on a campus where the vast majority of people want to finish their exams.
I take that point, David, but I must say, I always find it so perplexing that the Jews who have been historically persecuted and yet overcome their systemic discrimination aren't themselves the subject of progressive admiration. Why is that in your mind?
Oh, this is not a new story. Karl Marx, who invented the whole thing and who is himself a baptized Jew, wrote an essay called On the Jewish Question, which is the font and origin of left anti-Semitism. The Jews have always been an undigestible element in left-wing ideology. And there has always been on the revolutionary left, not the liberal left, where Jews have always found a comfortable home, but on the revolutionary left, Jews have always been a problem. Because, look, the central idea, and this is the Marxian idea, is that we are going to dissolve all identities into the identities of whatever the revolutionary movement of the time is, whether they're national, whether they're class, whether they are race, whatever those identities are, we're going to melt them down. And Jews have survived all these thousands of years by saying, well, you know, we always want to belong to the surrounding society as much as we can, but there's a part of ourselves that we want to preserve. We have our own tradition that we will never, the vast majority of us will never agree to dissolve into somebody else's demand. And that's why the comfort that Jews feel in society is such a mark of the health of the society, because a society that says you can be a Jew with that distinctiveness, and you can also participate equally, is a society that can say that to everybody, to whatever your particularity is. We do not insist that you dissolve yourself in the mass. You can be one thing in one context, and that's what it means to be free. That's what it means to be liberal. You can be one thing at home and something else. You can be, you know, you can be a woman who likes to wear, you know, high heels and dresses on party night and then go to the workplace and be treated mm-hmm. like anybody else. You know, you can be gay. You can have your personal life one way and then go into the public square and be treated like anybody else. And revolutionary movements never accept that. And so Jews have always, going back to the 1840s, they've always been a target of. This is not a new story. It was true in the 1960s and 70s with the rise of third worldism. And what has often then happened is because Jews have, because of the complex destiny of being a Jew, where it is often uncomfortable, and there are many individual Jews who say, yes, I want to dissolve myself into the mass. There have always been left-wing Jews who are attracted to communism or other movements who have been the worst persecutors. The Naomi Kleins are not new. They've always been such people. There's a famous, I think, apocryphal story about the rabbi who went to see Leon Trotsky when the communists were doing terrible atrocities against the Jews of Russia. Leon Trotsky was, of course, born, his birth name was Bronstein. And Trotsky shrugged off the rabbi, and the rabbi said, it is the Trotskys who make the revolution and the Bronsteins who pay the price.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Maybe you've seen in this very same podcast feed a new program called Hub Headlines. It features the best analysis and thinking of our writers each and every morning. It's delivered to you in a convenient audio format. In this podcast feed, all you have to do is click and download. And instead of reading Sean Spear, Howard Englund, Ginny Roth, any one of the terrific writers contributing to the Hub each daily, you can listen to them on the go. It's convenient. It's built for people like you with busy lives. If you're multitasking, if you enjoy the Hub but can't get on a screen, check out Hub Headlines. We've got you covered with the audio version of the Hub's best commentary and analysis each day. Again, you can grab this all on the same podcast feed that you are listening to this program now. Simply download each morning Hub Headlines and enjoy our best analysis and insights.
If a lot of the protesters are mostly motivated by the power of signaling rather than deep-rooted ideology, does that mean that concerns about anti-Semitism and illiberalism might be overstated? In other words, David, does it matter that many of them are cosplaying, or should we be merely focused on their words and actions?
Of course it matters, because the real question here of what's happening in the camp, the campus protesters don't matter that much. The campus permission structures that enable them do. I mean, look, if UCLA, which is home to, what, 40 or 50,000 people, if there were 1,000 pro-life students at UCLA, which is not impossible, and if they set up barricades in front of the library and said, no one's going to be allowed to use the library unless you convince us that you agree with us and we issue you a wristband, that protest would not last 5 minutes. But that's exactly what happened to UCLA. Anti-Israel people seized access to the library, issued wristbands on some pledge of allegiance to their cause, and eventually excluding Jews from using the library. And it was difficult for UCLA. People worried about it, wondered about it. And there's this debate among university administrators. So that's the real problem. It's not that there are jerks and bigots and people who enjoy violence for its own sake, and people who would rather goof off than study. Those people always exist. The question is, why are institutions unable to enforce their rules to protect certain minorities when they would eagerly enforce their rules to protect others? So it's the permission structure that is the question, not the banana phobic people.
In that vein, David, we've previously discussed the sudden and rather dubious shift on North American campuses from what amounted to effective policing of speech and thought to now claiming free speech and expression absolutism when it comes to causes like anti-Zionism. What does that kind of obvious inconsistency do to the credibility of these institutions?
Well, I unearthed a directive from 2014 where Columbia policed party costumes and just issued a notice. If you wear a Zorro costume to a party, we're going to punish you, but we want you all to consider that the university disapproves of that. And then exactly 10 years, almost to the day later, there's a story in the New York Times about how they're wrestling with the question of whether anti-Jewish protests are anti-Jewish. How much anti-Jewish protest is acceptable? So what it tells you is people are, when you spot an inconsistency, and this is a pretty glaring, what it tells you is there's a deeper principle that is the real principle at work. And what it tells you is that the policing of microaggressions was an assertion of a certain kind of power. And the non-policing of anti-Semitism is an assertion of a similar kind of power. And since it's the same people doing it, it tells us what they're really about, what the real belief system here is. That the ultra-safetyism of 2014 and the ultra permission of 2014, those by the same people are on behalf of the same goals. So now we can figure out we can do some trigonometry here, and we've got now two position points, and we've got the observer. So we can now better plot what is the real course of this project than we could when we only had one point.
Do you think, David, the universities who've permitted these protests and instances of intimidation and violence will face consequences in terms of enrollment, donations, and so on? Is there, in other words, room here for a market correction of sorts?
Well, the Harvards and the Columbias have both prestige and money to burn. And I don't think I very much doubt they'll see a drop off in enrollments. I think there will be some, I think the Columbia in particular has been really embarrassed. And UCLA, which is a state institution, which I think is going to face some scrutiny. And I think there's going to be some useful debate. I mean, I think one of the things that we're clearly seeing here is that in the late 2010s and early 2020s, under the impact of COVID and fashionable movements of that period, universities made changes to their admission standards. They got rid of the SATs. A lot of people were admitted who, frankly, would never have been admitted 10 years before and probably will not be admitted, if their types, 10 years later. That in the spring of 2020, if you wrote an essay about your activism, that was a plus. And now when the university gets that act, this guy has no SAT, but a lot of activism, maybe you should do something else. Maybe we don't need you at Columbia. So I think there'll be an adjustment of the academic intake. And I think, you know, a lot of universities will want to say, you know, the University of Chicago had it right. You need clear rules. So the president of the University of Chicago issued, of the many good statements that have been issued, and there are many good actors, the University of Florida, the University of Chicago, University of Washington at St. Louis. These have had very clear rules that were effectively enforced. But Chicago sent out an especially powerful statement where the president of the university talked about, here are the protests that we've had on the campus that we allow. So we had earlier in the year, he said, a big pro-Palestinian protest. There's an area of the university, which is traditionally set outside for student demonstrations. Students had massed some statement piece with Palestinian flags. They grouped into shapes and to make a statement. And they were there for 3 days with permission of the university in an understood place in a way that did not impede the access of other students to necessary university functions. And we did that for 3 days. And then it was dismantled at the end of 3 days in accordance with the rules. That is appropriate. And here's what we do not allow. We do not allow you to impede access to the library. We do not allow you to bang drums under students' dorm windows at 2 a.m. We don't allow you to single out particular classmates for harassment. These are, you know, at the margin, there are always some judgment calls here that the hard parts of law are the hard cases. But it's not hard to lay down general, sensible general rules that in advance everyone can understand. Yeah, you can make speeches without microphones at noon on the way to the cafeteria. You can't make speeches with microphones and bongo drums or in drums under dorm windows at 2 a.m. How hard is that? You can neutral time, place, and manner regulation, non-harassment of specific individuals, do not impede access to dining halls and libraries. Those are not hard rules to write. And I think we will see much more convergence. And then I think we've already seen some especially weak-willed leaders like those of Harvard and Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, step down. And I think we'll see some more action. I just one more thing about this. As I mentioned, the protests of the 1960s were much bigger and a much wider base social movement. But it is a little irony. I looked this up, a little irony of history, that the most visible student leader of 1968 was probably a man named Tom Hayden, who led a group called the Students for Democratic Society. And probably the most conspicuous university president who confronted protesters was a man named Simon Hayakawa, who was the president of San Francisco State University, part of the University of California system, who actually literally went out and confronted protesters. And they had an illegal sound truck that was magnifying the sound in ways that was prohibited by university. And he personally unplugged the sound truck. 8 years after these events, Hayden and Hayakawa are in the same race for the same Senate seat in the state of California. And Hayden loses in the Democratic primary. Hayakawa wins the Republican primary and then wins the seat. The leaders of tomorrow are not breaking the law today. The leaders of tomorrow are the people who are enforcing the law today.
That's a great historical anecdote and a good way to end today's conversation. David, I want to thank you for your insights, and I look forward to catching up in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation with David Frum, brought to you by The Hub, Canada's leading source for analysis and insights on public policy. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. Please share your favorite Hub podcast with friends and family and subscribe wherever you get your audio online. We also appreciate your ratings and reviews, so please leave us one. And a friendly reminder that you can access a video version of this recording anytime on YouTube. Simply search for The Hub or The Hub Canada, or go to our website, www.thehub.ca. I'm The Hub's Executive Director, Rudyard Griffiths. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, The Hub's Editor-at-Large. This episode was produced by Amal Atar-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.